Bracey Harris, thank you for joining me today. I'm looking forward to talking with you about all things education.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Good. So I know that you have been following the latest announcements from the governor down to school superintendents, and then you've been on the ground talking with teachers and parents and students as everybody is facing this question about what to do, how to return to schools, how to have schools this semester during COVID. If you could start by just kind of telling us what what's the lay of the land at this point. What do what is the variety of plans that you've seen from different school districts, and how has the reaction been among people you've talked to?
Yeah, so right now, what we've seen with school districts in Mississippi is they're really considering one of three options, which some are going full virtual, some are doing hybrid, where you bring back students for part of the week and then the other half they're learning online. And then some are going for the traditional 5-day model. So it's been really interesting to watch all of this unfold. Especially because, really, until last week with the governor's executive order, you sort of had superintendents and school boards, the way I like to put it, they were becoming epidemiologists on the fly. We didn't have like Virginia, where they really have like a red light, green light, yellow light system recommending, certain thresholds of community transmission or infection rates, or another metric, if you will, where that kind of guides, maybe you shouldn't open right now. We didn't have that until the executive order from the governor last week affecting a few counties. So, as a result, what we're seeing is that you can have districts with similar per capita rates of positive cases per a certain amount of residents, but they might take completely different approaches of whether or not they open their buildings, whether or not they bring students back 5 days a week if they open those buildings. And what that has resulted in, I think, for parents and educators is sort of a lot of confusion from different aspects. If you're a teacher in a district where you're being called on to, teach 5 days a week in person, but your peer in the neighboring school district has the opportunity of teaching virtually. Maybe they have to go and report to that building, but there's not the increased risk of exposure that you'd have with a full classroom. That kind of leads into, I think, some frustrations there. So right now, I think it's safe to say that it's really kind of all over the board with what you're seeing with districts, and there's not a clear metric, if you will, of how school leaders are making those decisions. A lot of them that I've spoken to, it was almost sort of this like gut feeling of bringing people to a table and asking for their input and then gauging their own comfort levels of, are these cases too high or is it spreading too quickly, versus this sort of set metric, if you will, for everyone. So that's been something that I've been keeping a close eye on.
Yeah, I know it's certainly been confusing. In my household, I have a teacher. I know a lot of folks who are listening are, probably have kids who are, they're in limbo right now. I'm curious, among the folks that you've talked to, what are the factors that they're weighing? You said that, they're sort of amateur epidemiologists. I think we all are at this point. But the governor keeps kind of talking about nuance and talking about weighing risk, cost versus benefits, looking at this not just purely through a public health lens. And to be sure, there are, vast sort of educational equity considerations part of this as well that I think we'll talk about. But I'm just curious, among the, you know, the school, particularly like the district and school leadership that you've talked to, what are the different competing factors that are swirling around in their heads?
Right. Well, I think one of the factors is definitely academic loss, and how do you balance knowing that coming in person for class is probably one of the best ways that kids learn, especially when you're talking about younger children that are literally going to need an adult or someone older next to them to log them in for virtual learning, to help them keep on task, to upload assignments. I think that school superintendents have been kind of weighing and being honest with themselves, you know, if we've spent the past 5 months not being able to instruct at the level that we'd wanted to, how do we come back from this now in the fall? And what I've seen with some superintendents that I talked to, and I think this was interesting, when I was talking with school leaders in the Delta, there was really kind of a hesitancy to bring kids back into school buildings, which, you know, I think probably might have been informed in part by, I think, health outcomes that were already in that region, lacking access to healthcare for a lot of families that were in that region. I think versus when I talked to a superintendent on the Gulf Coast who was thinking about learning loss too, and I think was pretty eager for kids to come back in person, to the point that there was controversy in this district of the first go round when they released their plan, they weren't going to offer remote learning to families that couldn't demonstrate that their child had a health condition. And then with the second go round, they said, okay, well, we'll expand it to families who, if any member of their household has a health condition, or you can participate in it as well if you have access to internet and your own digital device. So it was interesting to kind of see, you know, how those balances are playing out. And again, there's not really this great roadmap, I think, that's been put out there for school leaders that takes off some of this pressure. But I will say across the board, no matter what plan has been pursued, of course, I hear this sort of, I don't know how to put it, but almost sort of like sense of being tortured in a way. Mm-hmm. And there's not a really great option during this time. Like, all of these options are going to come with trade-offs. So
yeah, it seems like just as a general axiom of our response to this pandemic, everybody in a position of leadership has pushed decisions down the chain as far as they can, and often they land on individuals and families to make the best decisions for themselves, trying to aggregate a whole lot of information that seems to be rapidly changing. And that's been my sense of how the approach we've taken to school reopening, that the governor and the State Board of Education has pushed the planning down to the district level, and then the districts have pushed that down and given options to parents to choose what they want for their children. And I know that has, just from talking to friends of mine who have been put in that torturous position, trying to decide what's best for their kid, pitting health concerns against the educational concerns, trying to figure out whether they could even, you know, viably get childcare if their child was going to do a virtual option, or if they could stay home. And so it's, you have taken these huge, I mean, societal consequential decisions, and you've broken them up to the point where everybody is stressing over them and trying to figure out the right thing. And I'm not sure that anybody really knows. You wrote a really fascinating article about my alma mater, the Oxford School District, and some of the decisions that parents are making, parents and families are making, in terms of whether to go back into the building or whether to opt for a virtual option. And what you found there was that disproportionately it's Black children and Latinx and Asian families, to a slightly lesser extent, but who are choosing the virtual option much more than white parents, white families. I think if I may get this right, white students make up roughly half of the district's enrollment, but are about 2/3 of the students that have opted to go back in person this semester. And so you describe some of the reasons that families are making those decisions. So if you could just maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what you've heard and how in terms of racial equity, how these decisions are playing out.
Yeah. So I think what I heard when I talked to one mom down in Oxford, her name's April Harrell, and she's a Black mom. We talked about how her and her husband approached the decision of whether or not to send their son back. And as she explained to me, it wasn't like she, you know, was sitting at her dining room table and drawing out the numbers and saying, our community is being disproportionately affected, so I'm making the decision this way. But on the other hand, she pointed out it was almost as if she was on autopilot making it. Her hometown is in Milwaukee, which that city has been just absolutely devastated by the pandemic, especially along racial lines, with Black residents taking the brunt of that pummeling, if you will. So she said in some ways it was almost as if you came up to her and asked her, like, what was she going to do? Her response would be, duh, what else is there? And during our conversation, she said, you know, it wasn't on a conscious level, but the more that she reflected, she's like, yeah, there was this sort of subconscious knowing of what had been unfolding in her hometown and who those numbers were impacting. So in terms of equity, I think this is so important, because when we think about what the baseline was before the pandemic and what's been called the achievement gap, which is this sort of, you know, gulf along the lines of race, along the lines of socioeconomic status, in terms of how students are testing in schools, in terms of how many students from different groups are performing proficiently compared to each other, we know that foundation wasn't great. And so then when you bring in the data of who was more likely to have access to computers and reliable internet to do instruction during school closures, who was more likely to have parents with flexible work that would allow them to commute remotely, it becomes abundantly clear the kids for whom the stakes are the highest. And so that then puts school districts, I think, into this position. If we continue to see what happened in Oxford become a possible trend, that's the district that I have data from. We know from a recent Washington Post Ipsos poll that Black and Latino families were significantly more likely to say that schools were unsafe for reopening right now. How much that translates to making those decisions to, you know, stay home, I think still remains to be borne out. we know from Houston, Texas, that they're seeing some similar patterns to Oxford. But all of this is a long way of saying that, I mean, schools are really in a position where they're going to have to think carefully about how they set their game up with both in-person learning and remote learning for kids who lost the most this past spring. And I'll just say quickly, the way that Oxford has been thinking about this, encouraged by the district's equity director, LaTanya Robinson, was the first step was, we don't want a teacher who's in the classroom with students in the classroom being live streamed to students at home and having their attention divided and trying to keep up with, what are the facial cues I'm seeing on the Zoom? Is this kid grasping the material? Something that naturally just becomes more harder when the child's not in the room with you. They advocated that we need to have teachers, you know, assigned separately in person, virtual. And so far they, LaTanya told me, like, she's had good, I think, success with, you know, the district. She's even had some principals, I think, go a step further and identify their strongest teachers for that task. So, I think just to kind of wrap up here, it's a situation that you feel for administrative leaders, Darian, that they're having to navigate all of this, but there's still some accountability that has to happen. There's still some prioritization that has to happen to kind of weather all of this and give kids a fair start coming back.
We, of course, in the public health frame, talk a lot about pre-existing conditions and how they exacerbate the severity of COVID, that this virus preys upon people that have, you know, a set of pre-existing health problems. But really that, I think, the pandemic writ large has preyed upon pre-existing societal conditions that we've seen in really every aspect of our lives, of our communities. And so education, as you said, that we already have a large and persistent racial achievement gap that has historically been baked into the system of education in Mississippi. And what this pandemic is doing is not just reinforcing it, but really using those pre-existing conditions to cause more harm. And so it's the people that already were marginalized that are bearing a disproportionate share of the burden here. And that's something that I think, you know, we certainly need to take seriously. And I think that your reporting has illustrated that as well as anything that I've read since the beginning of this pandemic. Oxford, you know, is a district that has a lot of resources to work with. You know, they are able to have somebody on staff that is focused on equity. And so I think that, you know, there are certainly districts in the state that have the ability to try to close those gaps and have been thinking about it. And even if they're doing it in this confusing sort of reactive environment, they still have more ability to do so than many other places in the state. I think that they're more the exception than the norm. And so you've done reporting in Greenville and in the Delta. Think about the other side of the equation there, where you know, I think you have illustrated the challenges of that are faced by students and by their families, who are really trying to do their best and get a good education while also staying healthy and safe and staying afloat financially. Can you talk through some of that, you know, that other reality? you know, where we have the pre-existing conditions of economic inequality and poverty and health, you know, poor access to healthcare, poor access to broadband internet, as well as the racial achievement gap. You talk about sort of what it, what life looks like on the other side of that.
Yeah. When I think about that, I think about Lakeisha Perry, who is an educator in Greenville, and just some of the experiences she shared with me during this time. Greenville is a community that's, you know, not really connected in terms of how many families have access to reliable internet. And one of the things that she did when schools closed down is she used this sort of messaging system to create email accounts for her students and send them a survey for parents to access and respond back. Did they have internet? You know, did they have a device? And I want to say that she had around half of her families, like she just heard nothing back from at all, that she kind of took that as an answer of either there's not access to internet or this is just a time where families are going through so much pressure that they can't engage right now. And something that sticks out that she shared with me is that she could see when some of her students access the learning platform that they might be on like very late at night, or they might be on for only like 10 minutes. And that was a sign to her of like, this child is probably using a cell phone that's got a data cap on it. And like she told me, she literally had one family that she said, you know, if your child can only do 5 minutes, they can only do 5 minutes. So please, I need you to do that 5 minutes. And so when you think about, you know, 35 minutes for a week of getting to engage with some type of coursework, possibly, it's almost just unfathomable compared to districts that before any of this ever began had a one-to-one initiative where even pre-K kids had access to an iPad. So, I mean, I think it was really, whether you were affluent or you were in a lower income community, there was a really large chance that your school district was building the plane while flying. But I think that there was a lot, there was a big difference, right, in terms of what mechanics had to work with. And Greenville really was just kind of a microcosm of what you were seeing in similar communities throughout the state.
In your conversations with them, the teachers as well as the parents and students themselves, what are they asking for? Have they said what it is that they need or would like to see in order to be able to get a good education through this pandemic and in the future?
Yeah, I would say when I've talked, it's just overwhelmingly, it's been starting with having access to technology, having access to the appropriate number of digital devices. You saw in some districts, if they did have Chromebooks or they did, you know, have MacBook Airs to distribute to students, it was one per household, which if you're a family with more than one child, that gets complicated very quickly. And so it's having that device, and then it's also having access to reliable internet. And thinking about families that purely based on their location, they literally may not even be able to get broadband. It's not even a financial challenge. So technology, I heard about the need to hear feedback from instructors. I think that there's some families that if we get to the fall and their child's learning experience kind of consists of just like going through tutorials and taking quizzes and not getting some type of actual feedback, I think there's going to be an incredible amount of frustration. So a caveat there that, you know, I think some of that was, again, sort of reflective of trying to build a plane while flying this past spring. But I definitely know that's a change that parents are hoping for. I've also, heard from families with children that qualify for special education services. And there's a huge concern there of, you know, okay, we've gone through the spring, we've gone through the summer. In one case, I think some regression was experienced, I think it's safe to say. And it's like, how do we come back from this? Like, is there a way to think outside of the box of, even if we're doing virtual right now, can we set up office hours where a child might come in, you know, for an hour or so? Like, what are some ways that we can work through this? I think if I had to wrap up, like, what I keep hearing from parents and families is just moving past the sense of feeling that there's stillness or stagnation, just being able to see an effort, if you will, that there's a consideration of thinking outside the box to weather all of this.
Yeah, and of course, schools serve more of a role than just as a place of education. They are places where food is served. It's a community hub. It's sometimes where, you know, the front line of the healthcare system. It's where you get primary healthcare if you're a student. So it plays a much bigger role. And I think also, as you mentioned, serving children with special needs. So within the broader fabric of communities that are struggling right now and under stress, schools still have to serve some of those other functions, even if they're going virtual for the education piece. And so have you seen how schools are trying to do those other things and trying to be pillars of the community in the midst of this?
I've seen some districts that I think have taken on a pretty, you know, aggressive role of not only continuing meal programs during this time, but that also took the step of taking those meals to students if their families didn't have access to transportation. I think some school districts have made a concerted effort to have community outreach in a way of, we're not just updating you. This is thinking back to the spring of how we're going to do grading for this final semester, but we're also sharing information about where testing can be done, or this is what this virus actually is, and this is what you need to do to look out for yourself and your family. So I think that you have seen some school leaders really kind of stepping up into that role. Actually, when schools first shut down in March, before we even, I think, broached the conversation of remote learning, you had superintendents that said, hey, what comes first is making sure that thousands of children have access to meals that they're in danger of not getting during this time. So you've definitely seen education leaders, I think, look at, I mean, you hear all the time in education, like the holistic approach, the whole child. But I think this was a moment where you really did see, especially in more rural communities, schools really leaning into that role of being sort of a community connector.
So to switch gears slightly, at the beginning of this year, when COVID was just the occasional back page story out of China, you published a lengthy article looking at Holmes County and the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case, Alexander v. Holmes County, which effectively desegregated the remaining holdout schools in Mississippi and across the South, finally brought the full force of the federal government behind the Brown decision that had taken place 15 years prior. And so that's why, you know, most schools in Mississippi date their most public schools date their integration to the end of the 1969 or the middle of the 1969-1970 school year. And you went to Holmes County, to the center of that case, at least the lead case, and looked at the school system 50 years hence. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what it is that you saw there and what maybe surprised you when you were reporting that story?
Okay. So Holmes County has this multi-year battle for integration that starts with a group of plaintiffs in the district that file a lawsuit that just really outlines the differences between the school experiences in the county's Black schools and the county's white schools. They point out everything from differences to the structures of the buildings themselves, the access that students have to educational materials, the per pupil spending, all of that. And what first happens is the district in response looks to do this sort of freedom of choice plan where basically you'll have, you know, students by default are assigned to schools based on their race, but if you want, you can request to transfer to another school. And so what that does is there's strength in numbers, right? Like if you're only one Black family and you request to go into traditionally what's all the white school, it makes it a lot harder, I think, for a child to thrive in that environment. It makes families more susceptible to intimidation. And that's exactly what happened in Holmes County. So there's these kind of years of back and forth and legal wrangling. And finally, the Supreme Court, comes out with a case that sort of says freedom of choice on its own, or efforts that are similar on its own, are not enough to show that districts are making an effort towards integration. It's not enough to give families that option. And then if they don't choose that option, say, well, we didn't segregate the schools. So Holmes County, Mississippi districts really are given a timeline for basically showing that they have plans that are in compliance with this new court ruling. And what happens is Holmes County asks for an extension, which by this time it's nearing 15 years after Brown v. Board. So the excuse of we didn't know how to plan is understandably wearing thin. So another legal challenge ensues that makes its way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in a reversal of all deliberate speed, which is what happened with Brown versus the Board of Education, what's kind of known as Brown v. Board 2, says, okay, dual school systems must be abolished at once. And as a result of that, you literally have thousands of school children in Mississippi. This court case landed in October, in late fall. They come back from winter break to schools that are integrated. In the ensuing 50 years, you had already seen before this ruling came out, private academies start to pop up in the district with the sort of sometimes stated, sometimes understated purpose of avoiding integration plans. Sometimes families were in such a hurry that they literally transformed rooms at churches into classrooms because they hadn't built a separate school yet. So basically what happens in Holmes County are two things. One, from the county school system, the white population dramatically drops in terms of student enrollment over a sort of 3-year span. You also have Durant form as a separate school system in a wider school system. And actually, one local historian, Sylvia Giss, found school board notes that showed that that school system would allow white families from Holmes County to transfer in. So that happens, but over time, Durant's white enrollment consistently drops. And you kind of flash forward to 50 years where both school systems are more than 90% Black. And again, you can walk into classrooms and it looks like Brown v. Board, you know, essentially didn't happen. You could think that this is, you know, a town that only has one.
It's certainly hard to write, I would imagine, write a hopeful story or a positive story looking at this, you know, 50-year retrospective in what is still held up as a, you know, as a doing for very tangible improvements in their local school. And to go there now and to not see that, it has to make you feel like we've lost the promise. We've sort of failed to deliver on that promise somewhere along the way, maybe at all points along the way.
Yeah. I mean, something that was so striking to me, it didn't make it in the final version of the story. I have a very meticulous editor, but I remembered, I talked to several generations of Holmes County residents for this story. And something that just was so, it was just so, I mean, apparent to me is these sort of shared experiences of individuals I talked to, whether they graduated in the 80s or the early 90s or in 2015 or afterwards, was this kind of sense of being in a close-knit community, having educators that cared about them, that wanted to see them succeed, but then leaving Holmes County and going on to their next stage, whether that was college, and going through this sort of awakening of, I didn't get everything that I needed. I didn't have all of the exposure to subjects that I should have, to the higher level of math that I should have. And to just, once that spans a generation, you know, after the court case, like once you hear that from the first generation of kids and then the second one, yeah, I mean, that was really tough to just, cause I don't know what it is. Maybe it's cause I'm an education reporter, but, it's really fun when you go into schools, especially the elementary schools, and you see these young kids and they're really excited about learning and they're just happy and carefree, and knowing that the end point for some of them is putting their best foot forward, but leaving a system that did not ultimately give them an equitable educational experience is really unfair.
Yeah, I think the great value in taking that historical approach that you did is that it gets past one of the most pernicious parts of this debate is when you take a snapshot of the present and you say, well, this overwhelmingly Black school that has Black leadership and is getting per pupil just as much or maybe even slightly more than majority white schools with white leadership. And yet they are, on every metric we have, performing much worse. You can take a snapshot and you can use that as an indictment of the school leadership. You can make insinuations about them wasting money or misspending money. You can tell a virtuous story about the affluent white district doing more with less. But it ignores that historical deficit that you talked about that has been building generation after generation. So it's not about just what we're putting in now and getting out now, but really everything, how much more has been put into white education in this state and in this country over many lifetimes, versus how relatively little has been put into black education, and comparing it that way. And I think that that's, you know, I think that's what your story does really well. And I think that, we could certainly benefit from taking more of a historical perspective in our present day education debates.
Yeah. And we really don't, I think, mention that history a lot when we talk about how education looks today in Mississippi, but it is critically important, especially when you can kind of look at how that history ties into some of the community disinvestment that's taken place in some of these areas, like, for example, in Holmes County, and it's the prerogative of families to make that decision. But if you wanted to find where the majority of white children were in that county, you'd go to the private school that's there. And that school was actually, you know, founded during the time of having several of these academies pop up to avoid integration. And when you hear what the tuition is, it's not astronomical per se. Definitely out of the price point for the majority of families in the district. But when you hear what it is and you add up that enrollment and know that it's at least $1 million maybe that could have gone to a PTA or supplementing, you know, some type of instruction that's going on in the public schools, I think it's kind of striking to think about. Again, it is the prerogative of parents to make educational choices for their children, but I think it is important to understand the history of, like, how some of those schools came to be, even if parents aren't making those decisions, you know, based on the same reasons as maybe two generations ago. But it is important to take the long view of how we got here, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that goes to your point in this conversation, but also in the piece where you were talking about the physical state of the school buildings. And as a matter of policy, the state does not put money into capital expenditures. It doesn't give districts money to maintain or renovate or build new buildings. The money that the state is providing is largely going to pay for operational costs, pay for salaries, pay for transportation, keep the place running. And so I think where you, if school districts, you know, the buildings, the physical state of their buildings look like that they're going to reflect the state of their local tax base. And so in places like Holmes County, you see, you know, buildings that are deteriorating and have not been maintained. And I think it's largely because they have to tap local sources for that money. And a lot of those sources are tapped out. Whereas it takes a comparatively much lower commitment in a more affluent place to build a new building to give state of the art type of physical educational experience in your community. But I think that reflects, perhaps it's one of the manifestations of this historical compounding type of problem where, you know, this, like, capital investment, the state of your buildings is a reflection of what you've put into it in the past. Whereas operations is about just what you're paying in the present. And so if you can really see the compounded deficits very clearly in the state of our school buildings across the state, you can see it much more clearly than if you're just looking at data on expenditures and salaries and such. That's my observation. In a place, when you're talking to educators and parents in Holmes County, what are they asking state leadership for? What would they like to see from the legislature, from the education top brass in the state, to try to correct some of those historical inequities?
Yeah, I think one that came up was policies that are dedicated towards particularly keeping their school system's needs in mind. So I'll give an example. I think whether folks have agreed with it or not, I think the legislature has been pretty consistent over the past couple of years of kind of passing broad legislation in terms of educational goals. But when it comes to sort of drilling down to programs that are particularly geared towards meeting the needs of districts that are really struggling, there's sort of a gap in some ways, I think, is what is the feedback that you'll hear from folks in these communities. There have been some efforts like giving additional bonuses for National Board certified teachers in the Delta. There have been some, you know, cases that you can point to and say, okay, you kind of kept, you know, certain areas in mind. But it's kind of like if you approach the reform as children should be reading on grade level by third grade to improve their chances at having positive life outcomes, but you don't dig deeper into the root of which districts that have for years had, you know, high fail rates on this exam also have high numbers of elementary education teachers that are provisionally licensed, which means there's a chance that they have not yet gone through a teacher training prep program before receiving that temporary credential, or have a high number of long-term substitutes. Like, how does that play into, okay, there's problem, you know, X that you're addressing now? Like, I've just kind of heard this consistent feedback of wanting an acknowledgement and policies developed around the acknowledgement of unique challenges in certain areas. So, and with that, you know, there being funding, not just that everyone has been shortchanged by MAEP, but which districts have been able to weather those shortchanges better, and how do we think about prioritizing those with lower tax bases? So if I had to sum it up, I would kind of hear this constant drumbeat when I was reporting of making reforms more laser focused to address underlying issues that lead to underperformance.
And those underlying issues are often stemming from concentrated poverty, and then sometimes coexisting, but not always, racial segregation within the schools. On a community level, what sort of, you know, is there a conversation, like when you're talking about this, does it come up? Does the sort of racial composition of the schools come up, and do people think in terms of, or at least speak openly in terms of seeking integration as a strategy to improve racial equity?
So the community members that I would speak to, of course, with the caveat that, you know, one person doesn't speak for all, right? But the Black community members that I would speak to were really kind of, I don't know if it's too blunt to say over the idea of integration, but I think realistic about what's occurred, you know, in the past 50 years, that now would be the moment that folks would come back from the private school in town that's literally on a street paying homage to the Confederacy. Like what would take place now to have them come back? There was this real sense of like, this is not what we're fighting for, which integration never was simply just about, oh, we want to, you know, be near white school children. There were deeper aspects in terms of differences in resources and the kind of acknowledgement of the ladder towards true equal citizenship would require integration to happen. So I think, you know, when I would talk to members of a grassroots group, the Nolly Jenkins Center, you know, what one person told me is, you know, we can remain separate, but we need to be equal. There was just this kind of sense of agency of we're not going to wait for this tide to turn. Like, we can't wait for this tide to turn to have highly qualified teachers, to have our buildings in better conditions. Because again, it's kind of like what's happened in, what would make this the moment that it's happened? So there was definitely an acknowledgement of the aftermath of the case and the splintering off to private schools and what that had done in terms of resources and how schools were still feeling the ramifications of that today in the school district. But there wasn't just this eagerness of, you know, having a kumbaya moment, if you will, to fix everything.
Yeah. So is it fair to say that 50 years after Alexander v. Holmes County, that the failure to see the promise of that has created cynicism about integration as a strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a fair assessment. And I mean, some of you talk to folks too that went through that effort to integrate schools, like some of the community elders, as they might refer to themselves at the Nolly Jenkins Center. I mean, they shared some memories of that time period that weren't really pleasant and had the questions of, you know, why were we bused from our schools to achieve this? Like, why couldn't it have been the opposite? Like, why were we losing, you know, the aspects of our school experience that we loved and our traditions in terms of like, yeah, positive things, not in terms of, you know, but yeah, I mean, I think that there was, and there was also sort of sense of like, we, with one member I talked to, Janice, of like, we don't want our fates to be tied. Like, we want agency where we can do these improvements. We can hold this school system accountable. We can go march down to the state capitol and demand changes. We don't want it, you know, to depend on parents at the other school. Like, we don't want our kids' academic futures to depend on that. I do think that, if not cynicism is the right word, I definitely think that there has been a full-throated sort of embrace very forcefully of, we're the ones that are going to have to to change this now. This pathway of having integrated schools as a mechanism of getting our children what we deserve. We cannot wait on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that certainly does. You know, that there is a long history of Black organizing in Holmes County in particular. So even among, you know, even within Mississippi civil rights history, Holmes County stands out for, you know, having a lot of, you know, sort of efforts at autonomous Black organizing and empowerment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I even think about like the Mousin Cooperative and the history behind that, or even how, Robert Clark was, you know, the first African-American elected to the state legislature since Reconstruction. I mean, that happened because he was, you know, a principal in Holmes County, and he wanted an adult educational program, and the school board's like, well, no, we're not giving that to you. And so he's unable to run for superintendent because of, you know, the legislature adopting a rule preventing, you know, that area from having that taking place. And so then he goes and he runs for the legislature. I mean, there is, you're absolutely right. There's such a history of, I think, Black empowerment and agency in that community, very much so, of not in terms of, I think, being confrontational per se, or rejecting the idea of integration by any means, but very much so, again, this sort of recognition of, we're not going to sit here and wait.
Yeah, I love the story of Robert Clark. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, that "we're not going to sit here and wait" was his response when he got thwarted by the white school board and then the white legislature. And he ended up being the chairman of the House Education Committee when the 1982 Education Reform Act passed under our namesake Governor Winter, made it into law. And so, I think that if there, you know, as much as we talk about the failed promise of Mississippi history, there are plenty of hopeful stories within that as well. I would ask, just to, you know, to bring this to a conclusion, and if I might offer some attempt to try to weave together the different topics that we've talked about. I mean, it seems like, you know, education in Mississippi is by design a very decentralized system, one in which we really do leave it to families, to schools, to communities to largely go it alone. And that has bred pretty vast differences of experience and of opportunity based on who you are, where you live in Mississippi. And it certainly doesn't seem like state leadership is going to change that approach anytime soon and pass, authorize any new massive investment in education or take a stronger hand in terms of guiding the ship. And so it really does, it will be up to folks who are working school by school, community by community, to try to both weather the pandemic as well as to provide a quality education and try to redress many of our historical deficits and inequities. So if we could end maybe on a note or two of hopefulness, could you tell just, you know, what gives you hope from your reporting in the field? Who can you point to, or who do you think about when you think about what good, you know, what good is happening in Mississippi and what our potential is?
Yeah. I would say I'm actually hopeful from the conversations that I recently had with the Oxford School District. And I say that even though knowing they're more well-resourced than most, I think it was the attitude that, you know, knowing that, I want to say it was 4 years ago, the district came under well-deserved scrutiny for discussions around how the achievement gap would be addressed. And an idea was sort of briefly floated of, could we have a school that was targeted towards, you know, low income or student groups that were, you know, underperforming, that basically, you know, could have splintered off in a way mirroring, you know, segregation, who was learning in what school, even though it would have been voluntary. I think obviously the mention of that opened up a lot of wounds. And so to go and talk with, you know, school leaders there today and see how they're thinking about equity and online learning, to see how they have, you know, a statement on their district page that we acknowledge that the participation rates of students of color in our gifted and talented program, in our AP program, is not where it should be. And we're actually looking at assessments that can be more inclusive to diversify these efforts. And then how they have disbanded their separate alternative school program. I think that gives me, what gives me hope, and it's definitely not just limited to Oxford, is when you see school leaders that are willing to have that conversation and not just sort of understandably cringe when the topic of race comes up. I think what gives me hope is knowing that people are acknowledging what's going on. And then on the flip side of that, I think what gives me hope are educators like Lakeisha Perry in Greenville, who are still coming, you know, into work day after day in light of some pretty discouraging circumstances, but just dedicating their hearts and talents to sort of fighting against the current and doing their best to change current circumstances. That gives me a lot of hope too.
Bracey, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.